Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. Today's program is slightly schizophrenic. We have the smartest guy I know on the subject of Lebanon, Hussein Abdel Hussein, talking about a huge economic, social, and security disaster in what should be a great country, Lebanon. Hussein just had a piece on the Lebanese elections, which he's going to talk to us about, in Foreign Policy Magazine. You should go and find that. But before we go to Hussein, here is your JPC commercial. We were established in 1985 as a 501c3 organization, providing analysis and insight of both foreign and domestic policy. You can find us on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can see our insight articles, our In Context blog, In Focus magazine, and our blogs, Frontline Defense. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and permanence and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, we advocate for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. We have a lot on our plate these days. In this series of calls, we have been happy to bring you scholars and policymakers on issues including Russia and Russia in Ukraine, China, the Abraham Accords, and other aspects of Israeli policy and U.S. policy toward Israel. We've talked about what's going on in Iran, including the increasingly unhappy Iranian people, making it clearer and clearer that they hate the regime, and Biden administration policy that doesn't seem to care about what the Iranian people want. All of these are available on our website and on Facebook. Again, it allows me to say, go to our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. And as a reminder, questions and answers on the Q&A function, I will be monitoring them. And now our speaker, Hussein Abdel Hussein, is a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He focuses largely on the Gulf region and Yemen, including Gulf relations with Iran and Gulf peace with Israel. Born and raised in Beirut, Baghdad, and Baalbek, cities that have been at the center of major Middle East events, Hussein earned a degree in history and archaeology from the American University in Beirut. He worked as a reporter and then as managing editor of Beirut's The Daily Star. And he's reported from war zones on the Lebanese border with Israel. That might produce some questions for us. And from Iraq. In Washington, he helped set up and manage the Arabic satellite network Al-Hura Iraq, after which he headed the Washington Bureau of the Kuwaiti Daily, Al-Rai. He has been a visiting fellow at London's Chatham House and has published in English in the New York Times and Washington Post and in various Arabic publications. He's been quoted just about everywhere you think he should be. And he is a frequent commentator on Arabic satellite networks. So before Hussein went to FDD, we met on Twitter, which is like using an online dating service. You don't really know who you're talking to, and you don't know what you're getting. But we have found each other, and he has written for FDD some fabulous stuff. And as I mentioned, foreign policy. And he has written for us in Focus magazine from last summer's issue. He wrote Why There Is No Palestinian State. It is a must read, and blind dates or no blind dates, I am really happy to have made the acquaintance of Hussein Abdel Hussein. And Hussein, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Shoshana. The pleasure is all mine. Thank you, and thank you, JPC, for hosting me. A lot of things are happening these days in the Middle East. Not all of them make their way to the U.S. media and the U.S. discussion. On May 15, the Lebanese went to their parliamentary election, which happens every 4 years. But before I start talking about the election, I want just to briefly throw a few ideas about how authoritarian regimes work. For some reason that I don't understand and that most social scientists don't get, dictators seem to be infatuated with election. So even if they win 99% of the vote, which is, of course, a staged fictitious election, they still organize elections every 4, 5, 6 years. For example, Syria's dictator Bashar Assad is on his fourth or fifth term, and he's never missed an election. All of them, he's won over 90%. Same thing happens in all other autocracies. There's one important thing about Iran, which is a totalitarian regime that's been in power since 1979, is that Iran tends to give the population more margin in terms of debate than other countries. The regime, the Iranian regime, is designed in such a way that the ruling supreme leader controls foreign policy, defense policy, intelligence, and money. The state is supposed to handle everything that's domestic, whether it's managing infrastructure, budgets, education, all sorts of things that are usually given to regular governments. So the Iranian regime is designed in such a way that they also go to election every few years, 4 years. They elect parliament, they elect a president. All the world focuses on the election of the Iranian president. But the Iranian president and the Iranian regular army are much weaker than the Iranian supreme leader and the IRGC. So this is the Iranian model that Iran has been working on replicating in the countries that it currently controls, the Arab countries, Lebanon, Iraq, and Yemen, to an extent Syria. Lebanon is the most advanced in the replication of the Iranian regime model. So what we have is that we have a long tradition of state institutions electing a president, electing a prime minister, electing parliament every 4 years. Lebanon is one of the few countries where you can see two or three former presidents who are not dead or living in exile. So this tradition has given Lebanon some sort of choice and democracy for a long time. What Iran has done is that it used a loophole in the Lebanese course of history, let's say. After 1969, the Palestinian factions that were launching attacks from Jordan into Israel moved to Lebanon. And the Lebanese state, under pressure from Nasser at the time in Egypt and all other countries, conceded and let the Palestinians organize militias and launch attacks across Israel's northern border. Of course, attacks invited reprisal, and there was war until 1982, when Israel decided to invade and eject the Palestinians. What the Iranians did after the Palestinians were ejected was that the militia model was imposed by Iran and Assad. It was kept. So the state, even after the end of the civil war, never got back its sovereignty that it had lost in 1969. And since the end of the civil war in 1990 in Lebanon, and since the withdrawal of Israel from southern Lebanon in 2000, which would have theoretically ended their zone death for any militia, Hezbollah and Assad, and now Hezbollah alone, because Assad is long gone, he had to leave Lebanon in 2005. Hezbollah now has replicated the Iranian model. You have a state, a president, a prime minister, an elected parliament and speaker, and then you have Nasrallah and his militia. And the Nasrallah and militia, they have the upper say on almost everything, especially when it comes to war. Hezbollah has been engaged in the Syrian war and the Yemen war. It often threatens Israel. It has been engaged also in war in Iraq. So Hezbollah conducts a policy regardless of the state. And this has marginalized the state and undermined the stability of the country. When there's instability, there'll be no foreign investments. The economy naturally will stop growing. And this has been happening for over 10, 15 years. And when the economy is not growing, the state will have to fund itself mainly through national debt. So what Lebanon did was that between 1991 and 2019, it kept on borrowing and hiking interest and borrowing until in 2019, the state reached the end of the road, the economy collapsed, the national currency also collapsed. So now we got the Lebanese out in the street asking for a better life. So this was a new development, and everyone started pushing against the state. Now what Hezbollah is trying to do, like Supreme Leader Khamenei does in Iran. They use the government as a scapegoat to deflect attention. And they say, okay, you want to, you know, you want to change government, go ahead. But that has nothing to do with our arms. But in reality is that what Hezbollah needs, they need a government that will never go after their arms. What happened in Iraq and then what happened in Lebanon in October in Iraq, the pro-Iran militias lost miserably in the election. Their bloc shrank from over 100. The Iraqi parliament has 329 seats. So the Iranian bloc shrank from over 100 to less than 40. And by doing so, they lost the ability to control parliament. The bloc that won was the bloc that wanted all these pro-Iran militias in Iraq to be disbanded. So what happened since October is that Iran and its militias have managed to stall everything in Iraq. So since October until today we're June 1, there has been no election of a president and there has been no election of a prime minister and a formation of a new cabinet. And the executive authority in Iraq has been an acting interim one. And it's expected to be so with no end in sight. In Lebanon, what happened was that the people, like in Iraq, they said no to the Iran arrangement, to the Iran model, albeit a smaller no to an extent. So all of Hezbollah's allies either were knocked out of parliament or they saw their blocs shrink. Hezbollah in 2018, Hezbollah's alliance won a clear majority. The parliament in Lebanon has 128 seats. A majority would be 65. In 2018, Hezbollah had at least 75. Speaker of Parliament won 98 votes in 2018. So the Speaker of the Parliament is Hezbollah's ally. This election, Hezbollah and Nasrallah went on national TV to admit that no one has a majority anymore. So they lost majority. And the bloc that was elected is a bloc that's now emerging around what they call sovereignty. And sovereignty is a code word that's the antonym of Hezbollah's code word resistance. So Hezbollah says resistance in terms of we have to keep our arms to resist any foreign invasion or to go to war with Israel. And then you have the other guys who are saying we don't need militia arms. The arms have to go to the national army and the state has to have sovereignty. I will add to this that starting 2 years ago, the patriarch of the Maronite Church, which is in communion with Rome and the Catholic Church in Rome, started demanding what he calls region neutrality. Region neutrality is the arrangement that Lebanon had after 1949, when Lebanon participated in the Arab War on the State of Israel. In 1949, there was a truce between Lebanon and Israel, and this truce survived until 1969, which we said when the Palestinians came to Lebanon and broke the truce. So what the patriarch is saying is that he's saying, let's go back to December 1969 before the state conceded its sovereignty. So this means that Lebanon will enter into regional neutrality, mainly with Israel. And it means that Hezbollah will have to surrender its arms to the national army. Over the past 2 years, Hezbollah has tried to ignore the Maronite Patriarch. The Maronites form around one third of the population. And the Maronites, of course, the formation of Lebanon has been attributed to the Maronite Church and the Maronite community. So to speak, they've been the sponsor of Lebanon, and now the Maronite Patriarch is asking Hezbollah to abandon its arms. And now with these elections, we have a bloc that's as big as 60 out of 128 that is supporting the patriarch's idea or initiative of regional neutrality and disbanding Hezbollah. Yesterday, the parliament held its first session. It re-elected the same speaker who has been in his position since 1992. It elected Nabih Berri for a seventh four-year term. Now, while this might look like as if business as usual, you have to keep in mind that in 2018, Berri received 98 votes. Yesterday, he received only 65, which is half plus one. So he barely made it. This is the lowest number of votes he's gotten over the past seven elections that he've had. And another interesting development was that for the position of deputy speaker, we had two candidates, one from the Hezbollah Alliance, a Christian guy who belongs to President Aoun, the Christian ally of Hezbollah, and another guy who called himself the candidate of the sovereignty bloc. The Hezbollah guy got the 65 votes that they have. The sovereignty bloc received 60 votes. And I'm pointing this out because it's really important that the 60 votes are subscribing to the idea of sovereignty. And this is something that's new. This is something that's developing. And if you read my foreign policy piece, I advocate for Washington to show support to these guys, maybe to invite the Maronite Patriarch in 2005. Former President George W. Bush invited the Maronite Patriarch Sfer at the time, and that invitation eventually culminated in Lebanon ejecting the Assad occupation of Lebanon after 30 years. So if we try to replicate the supermajority that the Lebanese had in 2005 that forced Assad out of Lebanon, if we manage to replicate that with Washington support, I think the Lebanese, we can probably put the Lebanese on the right track. This is not a promise that things will change overnight. If the Lebanese ask or form a supermajority that asks Hezbollah to disband, I expect Hezbollah to do what the Iranian militias are doing in Iraq, just resort to violence, assassinations, arm twisting, social shaming, you name it. But what should be done should be done. The Lebanese who are asking for freedom, who are asking for the disbanding of the militia, I think they deserve our support. And they might one day push in the direction of democracy like they pushed Assad out of Lebanon after 30 years. The last note that I'll leave you with before we go to questions. The current U.S. policy in Lebanon is crisis management. So because of the financial collapse, the economic collapse that we have, what Washington has been doing is that we've been funding the UN's World Food Program, WFP, to literally feed people to prevent a famine. We have been bankrolling the Lebanese army and security forces to make sure that there's a semblance of order. And we cooperate with these guys to try to stop the trade of narcotics. Lebanon, like Syria, are turning into the capitals of narcotic manufacture and export in the world. And the third point is that the U.S. has been helping the Lebanese army, mainly by supplying boats to patrol the Lebanese coast to stop refugees from getting out of Lebanon and eventually flooding Europe and the rest of the world. So the U.S. policy currently is crisis management, and I really advocate for going beyond crisis management and show minimal support to the sovereignty bloc, invite other sovereignty figures, and try to get things to move beyond crisis management, maybe put it on the way for or the early steps of actual solution for the country.
Oh, that was much more positive, much more optimistic, actually, even though it's not really optimistic. It's more optimistic than I thought it might be. So let's start with, I have a number of questions and I might sort of run them together because people have been sending things in. But the first question is it misleading to talk about Lebanon as if it were actually a nation state rather than a geographic area populated by different ethnic and religious groups, which are being used against each other and as a buffer by Syria and Iran and Israel for other things? Is it really a country?
Well, I think all countries are countries like this. I mean, you know, look at Switzerland, one of the most successful states, and they have probably five languages and 10 ethnicities. And they could come together and form a successful state. Turkey, half of Turkey is non-Turkish Kurds. I think everywhere you look, you will find a diversity of in terms of tribes and sects and ethnicities. And even if you try to look up the ethnically homogeneous countries, take Egypt, for example, where 90% of the population is both Arab and Muslim, and 100% of the population is Arab, and no one is intervening. But we still have many problems in Egypt, economy and other things, and policy and management. And so what Lebanon, the problem in Lebanon is not the diversity. The problem in Lebanon is that the majority of the population cannot tell the difference between identity and policy. So when people go to the ballot box, they vote out of identity. And that's why the people who want change are still a minority, maybe a big minority now, maybe getting close to a majority. But when people vote, the Shia vote for the Shia and the Sunnis for the Sunnis because they're thinking of themselves as identity. And most of the time, they try to play back old battles and revenge from 1500 years ago. But if the Lebanese, if there's enough awareness for the Lebanese or any other citizens in any other country, if these people start realizing that their vote is connected to the policy and the policy is connected to their interests and their well-being and their economy, then I'm sure Lebanon will become a country like Switzerland, like France, like everybody else. So I've heard this thing that Lebanon was put together and, you know, in a wrong way, and it doesn't really fit together because it has so many diverse tribes and you know, populations, or call them whatever you want. But I think it's been over 70 years now. These guys perceive of themselves as Lebanese. And my personal experience, all the people I see, whether Shia, Sunni, Maronite, something, Druze, all of them perceive of themselves as Lebanese. The problem is that they have no, they don't have the culture required for democracy to strike root and to move the country in a better direction.
Is that partly a function of Iran and Hezbollah with its military? I mean, there must be some dampening effect by, there was in Iraq, certainly.
Well, Iran, of course, Iran will use whatever weak points that it can find. And in this case, the weak point is that militias were recruited from impoverished people who turned into mercenaries with the Palestinians, and then they just continued doing so with Hezbollah. Mind you, a big majority of people who are Hezbollah leaders today started either as communist or as pro-Baath, Iraqi Baath Party, and all kinds of secular ideologies. And they ended up being all religious and with Hezbollah. So these guys are not really about the ideology. They're more about the interest and the money and, you know, making a living out of it. So Iran, number one, Iran exploited this weakness. And number two, what's going on now, even if we get a majority that's against the militia model that Iran is imposing, say like what happened in Iraq, the problem with arms is that they have the capability of ruining any majority, twisting enough arms, stalling the state like they've been doing in Iraq, assassinating pro-democracy activists. So all these things, you only need a handful of armed people, armed thugs, who can really spoil it for everybody else. So even if you get a majority that supports democracy, if you have a small militia, it can really terrorize everybody else and keep them under its thumb. So I think this is where Iran comes in. The Iran model itself, Iran is exporting a model. Iran does not perceive of these people as a mercenary in a forest. They think that this model, when replicated, produces a confederacy under Iran's supervision. And this confederacy, you know, Lebanon at this point is only an Iranian missile base whose mission is to threaten Israel. And I think that's the only thing that's of interest to Iran. And we know that Iran thinks if there's ever a strike on its nuclear facilities or targets, whether by Israel or by the United States, Hezbollah will certainly be engaging Israel in war. And that's the only raison d'etre for Hezbollah at this point. And this makes Lebanon a war zone, and this naturally kills the economy. So, but Iran doesn't care. Hezbollah doesn't care because Hezbollah is not connected to the Lebanese economy. Hezbollah gets its money from Iran. And that's why removing the sanctions currently imposed on Iran would be a horrible idea, not only for Iranians and the nuclear deal, just for pretty much everyone in the region, because the Iranian militias in Iraq will get money, in Lebanon will get money, in Yemen will get money, and whatever looks now as if things are receding and moving in the right direction, we'll be back to square one.
So two questions have come in from listeners. One on Iranian money and sanctions. Can you find an increase in money to Hezbollah or an increase in missiles or weaponry to Hezbollah that coordinates with the lifting of many U.S. sanctions on Iran is one question. And the other is, are there any indications of fracturing within Hezbollah, within the party of Hezbollah inside of Lebanon, or does it remain a single unified party?
Well, on the first question, Iran needs much more money than the money released that they've had so far. So we know that the U.S. Unfroze billions that were in South Korea and in Iraq, and these were debts that these governments owed to Iran. But the amount of money, I don't think, is enough to grease the wheels for everyone. So a few Iranian militias were happy with the money, maybe the top leadership in Hezbollah. But this money was not enough to go back to pre-2018, before President Trump withdrew from the nuclear agreement. So in 2017, all these militias enjoyed a lot of money, and they were recruiting people. At this point, they're not recruiting. They're barely keeping the people they have. On the second question, whether there are any fractures within Hezbollah. Hezbollah is designed in such a way that it has layers. The smallest circle, the supporters, the friends, the allies. So we've definitely seen Hezbollah lose a lot of the outer circles, the friends and allies. The defeat of these allies in the Lebanese election was remarkable. We're talking about people who've been in parliament for 20, 30 years, and they're Hezbollah's allies, and they rely on Hezbollah for electoral money and for other kinds of support. And these guys just vanished and lost to independent newbies, new faces, who made their name participating in the 2019, what the Lebanese call the 2019 revolution against the system and Hezbollah. So Hezbollah definitely lost a lot of outer circles. Whether the inner circle got shaken, I'm not sure. Things are not really transparent, and we're not aware of what happens in the intimate corridors of Hezbollah. But I would say at this point, the nuclear circle of Hezbollah, the small circle of Hezbollah, I think is still intact. It still has a lot of money, and it's improving in terms of technology. So it is very likely that Hezbollah at this point has guided missiles that it will use in a war against Israel. And this is new technology that they never used in previous wars. So Hezbollah is honing its talents, its war abilities. It's acquiring, or it's at least it's getting from Iran, these explosive drones that are used in Iraq and against Saudi Arabia and against the UAE. So Hezbollah is still building its arsenal. But Hezbollah is not expanding in terms of rank and file. It's not expanding in terms of the social institutions that usually support the statelet of Hezbollah, because we know Hezbollah is a statelet within the Lebanese state.
So you mentioned that part of the problem of Lebanon in the last decade or more is economic and its inability to create an economy that allows people to work and make money. One of the best ways to work and make money, it seems, in the Middle East these days is to go to the Abraham Accords. Do the Lebanese people look at the Abraham Accords and look at the economic and social and political benefits, both for the Gulf states as well as for Israel? Do they look at that and say, wait a minute, we could have that, right? Or do they look at it and say, no, those Gulf Arabs are traitors to the larger method? What is their view of the changes in the region?
Well, I don't have numbers to suggest percentages. I know that there's a big chunk of friends and family and Lebanese people who live in the UAE and who've come into contact with Israelis and who work with Israelis, which is against the Lebanese law, but I think they probably do it discreetly. And these Lebanese, many of whom I met this past December when I was in Dubai, these Lebanese understand that peace is an economic growth multiplier. And they understand that it's a Lebanese interest to have peace with an economy that's right across the fence, that's 50 times the size of a Lebanese economy. So it's a net win for Lebanon if it goes into peace with Israel. I don't think these people are vocal. They don't say what they're thinking out loud or in public. You have another chunk of people who think that, in the very least, we should go to neutrality. Again, back to what the Maronite Patriarch is talking about. And this has been growing because the Lebanese are now thinking, and I make this clear in the foreign policy article, they're thinking of the model that they had between 1949 and 1969. Everybody in the world, or our ancestors who lived in Lebanon at the time, they call these years as the golden years of Lebanon. So in the very least, the Lebanese want to go back to a time when in 1967, all Arab countries engaged Israel in the 1967, the Six-Day War. Lebanon was sitting. They did not participate. They were making money. They were dancing. They were happy. And I think the Lebanese remember that, and they want to go back to that. And this is the neutrality. Now, neutrality is much better than what they have now. I don't think neutrality is as good as peace, but maybe we should take it step by step. Now, finally, you have the people, the Hezbollah core, the hardcore pro-Palestinian constituency. And these are the guys who almost always think of identity, not of interest. So they think, okay, you know, these Jews are not Muslims, or they're not Arabs. We're Arabs and we're Muslims. The Palestinians are Arabs and Muslims. Therefore, we should fight until the Palestinians, you know, get whatever they want. I think this circle of people is shrinking. I think their numbers are dwindling, but they're still there. And what's worse is that there still aren't. So at this point, people who support peace with Israel, they're probably, if they do so in public, it's risky for them to be in Lebanon. So of all the campaigns, I know many of the people who were campaigning and who made it to parliament who support peace with Israel, but would never say it out loud. And the reason why this, you know, risks their, this puts a great risk on their lives. The other people are calling for neutrality. I think they're doing it with some hesitation because that's dangerous too. But I see movement. I don't claim that this is necessarily a majority, but it's much bigger than I expected only a few months ago.
So the election results were a surprise to you?
It was a surprise to an extent that I did not expect, especially yesterday. After these independents won, I did not expect them to rally around a candidate who calls himself a pro-sovereignty candidate. And pro-sovereignty means automatically disbanding and disarming Hezbollah. So this idea, because you have a big number of independents who think that the problem of Lebanon is the corruption of the state, who think that there is a solution where we can fix the state, where we can get rid of corruption without actually touching Hezbollah's arms and just keep the Hezbollah militia and arms as a tool for self-defense, for national defense in Lebanon. The point that many of us have been making, myself included, is that there's no way we can fix corruption without taking care of the arms, because the arms are protecting the corrupt oligarchs. In return, the corrupt oligarchs are giving a pass to the arms because they're unconstitutional. So what we will see next is that Hezbollah will try to form a cabinet, and the cabinet usually has a platform that it presents to parliament. And in this platform, over the past 20 years, Hezbollah has made sure that there's a sentence that says this cabinet is dedicated to protecting the people, the army, and the resistance. And keeping the word resistance there is the legitimacy that Hezbollah needs. So if you get a state that stops saying that, Hezbollah will just stand out as an unconstitutional militia. So this is why Hezbollah fights for the election, even though everyone thinks, why do you need the election? You have the arms, you know, whoever wins, you have the arms, and that's that. Hezbollah still needs the legitimacy from the state, and that's why it protects the corrupt oligarchs in return for their support. So it becomes kind of a symbiosis. And what we try to reason with the independents who think they can fix things without touching Hezbollah's arms, we try to explain this symbiosis to them and say, listen, no matter how hard you try, if there are arms that are not reporting to the elected government, that means it's still lawless. That means corruption will persist. Everything that's lawless will persist.
So talk a little bit, if you would, about Lebanese Christian community. I'm old. I remember a time when Lebanese Christians were allies of Israel in a sort of group, as a single unit. And many of them crossed the good fence to work in Israel in the 1980s. I met many of them in the early 80s. What's the Christian community doing now? I understand some support Hezbollah, some perhaps not.
Before we talk about their politics, let me just note that as someone who's read so many books about the Jews who used to live in Arab countries, how their numbers dwindled over time, how their neighborhoods, you know, got empty. I think it's the same images we see with Christians now, even though no one is going after Christians to eject them. But the surrounding becomes hostile to an extent that Christians, first, they start consolidating, moving from towns or villages where they feel themselves as a majority, and they move to other towns where they can be a majority. So you have the Christian territory has been shrinking over the past two decades. Christians are migrating. They're not, the birth rates are going down. Their economic clout is going down. So there's not a single indicator that suggests that the Christian community in Lebanon is thriving, or at least is maintaining the numbers and the economics that it once had, even in the 1980s, during the Civil War. The Christians were much more numerous, much more powerful than they are now. So it's a sad story that Christians are dwindling, the numbers of Christians are dwindling in Lebanon. And I think that's one of the main reasons that made the patriarch call for what he's calling now. He understands that with this situation, with this economic situation, Christians will not stay, and eventually this whole country will turn into a monolithic Muslim population. So this is the number issue. The politics of the Christian community, that when they ejected in 2005, when the Lebanese ejected the Syrian forces, Assad's forces who were occupying Lebanon, at the time, Christians were living what they called Christian frustration, because their top three leaders, one was in prison, one was in exile, the President Aoun, who's now the president, and a third guy who was killed before these two. When Assad was forced out, the Christians thought, okay, now this is the time to reset and go back to traditional Christian politics. And traditional Christian politics is extremely pro-sovereignty. The Christians fought a civil war especially to preserve the sovereignty of the state against the Palestinian militias. So when the Christians thought they would reset, what Aoun did was that he decided that, but Hezbollah is a local power, so we have to talk to them because they're Lebanese. So Aoun took the side of Hezbollah, or actually he was probably peeled away by Hezbollah, promised the presidency. Why Hezbollah did that was because by doing so, they broke the supermajority that was against them. They peeled Aoun out. They gave him the presidency. And Aoun brought with him a Christian faction that has been shrinking ever since he switched sides. And what we have now is that we have the Christian network that's supportive of Aoun. Now, these guys have been rewarded with state corruption, contracts or positions or civil service or whatnot. So this small network of Christians is still there. These elections show that this bloc has been shrinking. The son-in-law of President Aoun, Gibran Basile, whose ambition is to succeed his father-in-law, in 2018 got 12,000 votes in his district. On May 15, he received only 8,900. And that's 27-30% of his vote. That's how much shrinking in the popularity of Aoun and this Christian faction that's supportive of Hezbollah. At the same time, the Lebanese forces, which is the Christian group that stayed anti-Hezbollah for all this time, it won 5 seats in 2005. It won 20 seats in May 15. That's an increase of 15 seats over the period through which Aoun switched sides. So these are the numbers and the trends I'm talking about. The Christians are increasingly leaving Hezbollah and joining the Lebanese forces and supporting the Maronite Patriarch. And the sovereignty, and that's why we see the sovereignty bloc growing in parliament and otherwise. So are these Christians still more supportive of Israel and Lebanese peace with Israel? I'd say at this point, even if they do, they won't say it. And I think at this point, they're all probably rallying around the patriarch because, of course, the patriarch has this kind of spiritual leadership and he is immune. Hopefully, he is immune to Hezbollah's violence. So whatever he says, he can say it out loud. And what these Christians do is that they say, okay, if he's saying it, we're behind him, you know, and if you have a problem with it, just sort it out with the patriarch. So I would say a majority of the Christians currently supports neutrality, to say the least, and disbanding Hezbollah. That's for sure. How far these Christians will go back to the traditional line of asking for peace with Hezbollah or maybe asking for peace with Israel and allying with Israel, that's for the future to show.
So this then leaves an opening for the United States. We have to talk about the United States. We arm and train the Lebanese armed forces. In theory, we do that because we believe that it is the guarantor of a unitary state of Lebanon. Is the Lebanese armed forces, first of all, would they be able to secure the unity of the state of Lebanon if Hezbollah didn't want them there? Do they cooperate with Hezbollah? What are we doing? Are we making things better or worse with our support for the Lebanese armed forces?
First of all, there's no army that looks different from the country. All armies reflect their countries. And if the country is divided along sectarian lines, so we should expect the army to be divided along similar lines. So number one, the Lebanese army is much weaker than Hezbollah. If there's ever full-scale battle between the two sides, Hezbollah will prevail. Now, Hezbollah will prevail, but I'm not sure Hezbollah can hold the territory that it might win. But the army cannot disarm Hezbollah. So any disarmament of Hezbollah should be negotiated. Whether with Hezbollah or whether, you know, I'm not saying with Iran, but if we get the Lebanese to form reconstitute their supermajority, then they can probably force Hezbollah to disarm. So the army on this side is not helpful. The army is helpful to an extent that it can impose some law and order. For example, against possible ISIS infiltration, which is not really that, the probability is not really that high in Lebanon for other security issues. But the army is not doing what it should. I think Washington should use leverage more with the army. So in 2008, when Hezbollah launched a punitive military campaign against the Druze of Walid Jumblat to force him to leave March 14 and just leave March 14 and stop talking about sovereignty. The army didn't act. It just stayed on the sidelines. And the justification was that if the army acts, it'll split. And then we were all saying, then why do we need an army if it cannot protect the Druze from the Hezbollah militia? The third thing about the army is that by constitution, the army chief has to be a Maronite, just like the president. And all army chiefs have been ambitious to become president. So if you take the last three presidents or four presidents in Lebanon, Lahoud, Sulaiman, and Aoun, all of them have been army chiefs. The last three presidents have been former army chief of Lebanon. With this guy, Joseph Aoun, I think he has a similar ambition. And he thinks if he can be gray enough that the U.S. likes him and Iran okays him and, you know, everybody inside and outside likes him, then he can become president. So this is one problem with the army, is that at all times the army tries to remain neutral because its chief is trying to remain gray to be elected president. I think the U.S. should threaten the army more, or not threaten, at least just to say this $100 million that we give you every year. It has to be money well paid, because at its stand, it's not money well paid. Just let me add that we also pay a big amount of money to the UN, the UNIFIL, the peacekeeping force in the south. This is a force that has 10,000 men. It costs $500 million every year, of which the United States is the biggest donor. And the UNIFIL does not do what's supposed to do, which is to make sure that there are no arms south of the Litani. So I think one of the best ideas is to ask the UN either to change the mandate of UNIFIL to make it, to enable it to go everywhere and check for Hezbollah's arms, or to downscale it back to 500 people. There's no need to spend all this amount of money for a force that's just standing there that can't do anything.
I used to meet with them, and I thought it was worse than that. I thought they were actually in favor of Hezbollah. I thought they and opposed to Israel. And they're not supposed to be for or against anybody. They're supposed to do a mission, and I never felt like they were doing the mission.
I think the only useful purpose that we can get out of them, in the absence of channels between Lebanon and Israel, they play the role of a conduit. But you don't need 10,000 people to do that. You need 50 people, and that's that.
And a cell phone. So we're coming to the end of the program. Several people have asked the question. This is not on our list of things to talk about today, but maybe you can for a minute. The Beirut port disaster of 2021. Does anybody know who did it? Does anybody want to say who did it? And what has been the impact of that on Lebanese society?
Well, even if we didn't know who did it at the time, the fact that Hezbollah stonewalled and stopped the investigation altogether, killed it technically, suggests that they have something to hide. I mean, only the culprit, the guilty, would try to stop justice. If Hezbollah was not, if the amount of explosives in the port that destroyed the port and half of Beirut, if this amount of explosives did not belong to Hezbollah, then why is Hezbollah afraid of justice? Let investigators do their job. Now, what Hezbollah says all the time, and this is the same excuse that it gave about the assassination of Hariri. In the assassination of Hariri, we have a UN tribunal that indicated that Hezbollah killed Hariri. At the time, Hezbollah said it was opposed to justice because it was being politicized and used against it. Now we hear the same excuse, that they killed the investigation because the US and Israel, everybody else, was trying to conspire and use this investigation against Hezbollah. This is a lame excuse. So to me, this is indication enough. I don't have any facts in front of me. I haven't read any reports that would, indicate that this was Hezbollah's explosives. But their behavior toward justice indicates that they were responsible.
So could that have had an impact on Hezbollah losses in the election? Could people have looked at that and said, what you said, and maybe I don't want to vote for them?
I think you have at least 250 families, bereaved families in Beirut because of the explosion. And that's aside from all the people who got their houses destroyed. In most of Beirut, Hezbollah didn't fare well. I mean, its candidates made it. The Shia, they won the Shia seat. But overall, Hezbollah didn't go, the election didn't go Hezbollah's way as much as Hezbollah had expected in Beirut. And I think that was one of the major reasons. And what you see now, the independents who made it to parliament, they always use the port as one of the issues that they have with Hezbollah. They added to the corruption and all these kind of things, but it's become a rallying cry against the party.
So I want to thank you, because I tell you what, I learned a lot here about Lebanon, about elections, about how things are going. And I am sure that our listeners also learned. So thank you. People who listen often know that I like to go out on a happy note. We have no happy note, I don't think. How about a positive note? What's your positive note? What optimistic thought can you leave us with? Is the optimistic thought actually sovereignty and neutrality? I mean, it's a step in the right direction.
So let me leave with this. There are many people in Lebanon who are still fighting for democracy, risking their lives. There are people who are fighting in these elections. I was personally surprised to see them still. I mean, many people just gave up. So these people are teaching us lessons. And I'm one of the people who stand in awe and I'm trying to follow them. And what I'm trying to tell them is that anyone who fights for democracy will find a friend in Washington and especially in the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, of course. But if these guys are willing to stand up and fight for their democracy, they'll find friends here. I was really pleased and impressed and surprised to see them still doing what many of us just gave up on doing a long time ago. And I think for that, they deserve all our support and credit.
Well, they can find a friend at the Jewish Policy Center as well. Bring your friends over and they'll be our friends. And I think that is a good note. You know, we sometimes in the United States forget how difficult it is in some places to vote and to have a voice and to try to make your voice count and try to make things better for your people. We forget that we have it relatively easy here. We complain a lot, but we have it relatively easy, and the people of Lebanon do not. And so to the extent that we can help them, we're all in. Thank you again for your time, for your education of our people, and we hope to see you back here soon.
Thank you, Shoshana. Thank you, JPC. Hope to see you soon.